This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll get to my interview with crime writer George Pelicanos. But first, let's listen to Terry's conversation with Ava DuVernay, who directed the new film Selma. Selma dramatizes a turning point in civil rights history when Martin Luther King came to Selma, Alabama, to help lead a series of three marches demanding voting rights for black people who were systematically prevented from registering to vote in the South. Those marches led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. DuVernay won the Best Director Prize at Sundance in 2012 for her film Middle of Nowhere. Now she's up for a Golden Globe for Best Film Director for Selma. This makes DuVernay the first African-American woman to be nominated in that category. Selma's bigger in scope and budget than her previous films. Oprah Winfrey is one of the producers and plays the part of Anna Lee Cooper, a voting rights activist who was prevented from registering several times. In this scene, she's trying again, but faces what many blacks in the South faced at the time, a difficult civics test designed to prevent African Americans from voting.
You work for Mr. Dunn down at the rest home, ain't that right?
Yes, sir.
Wonder what old Dunn will say when I tell him one of his gals down here stirring a fuss.
I ain't stirring no fuss. I'm just here trying to register to vote.
Recite the Constitution's preamble. You know what a preamble is?
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Name them.
And that bang that you hear at the end is the sound of Annie Lee Cooper's application to register to vote being stamped denied. Ava DuVernay, welcome to Fresh Air. Your movie Selma starts with Martin Luther King getting dressed for the ceremony at which he will receive the Nobel Peace Prize because of his efforts as a peaceful civil rights activist. Typically in biopics, the rest of the film would be a flashback telling us about the remarkable achievements that led to that point of him receiving the Nobel. But your film keeps moving forward. And it's just horrible to see that even after he gets the Nobel, black people are being turned away at the polls in the South and beaten by the police if they peacefully protest for the right to vote. And I'd like you to talk about deciding on the structure of the film, deciding to start with this like high point of recognition from around the world and then going back into the trenches where black people still have few rights.
Well, that's really exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to show his place on the world stage at that moment. At the beginning of Selma, you know, at the end of 1964, he accepted the Nobel Prize, and he was lauded by heads of state and royalty. And he came home, and he didn't have an appointment to even see the president in the White House. There was no celebration of that moment here in the ways that I think they thought there would be. They came back home, you know, found themselves back where they were when they left. And so at that moment, he is, you know, he had options. He could have done any number of things, not the least of which being invited to work with Johnson in some capacity within his administration. But he chose to go back and work with the people and remain with the SCLC and have that independent spirit, that independent voice around his activism, which is something that just always fascinated me. Because at that point, he had been in the movement for a decade. And, you know, had been the subject of death threats and an assassination attempt, a stabbing. He had been beaten. I mean, his family had been terrorized. I mean, it was a good moment where he could have probably stepped out if he was a lesser man, but he didn't. And they went right back into the trenches and right back into Selma. And that, I think that's fascinating.
You also depict the infamous and horrible bombing of a Birmingham church in which four young girls were killed. I didn't realize that was about to happen when I saw the film. So I was just shocked when the bomb exploded. It's you know, it's obviously very upsetting to witness this, even though, you know, I knew it happened historically, but I wasn't expecting to witness it on screen at that moment. Can you talk about deciding how to shoot that?
Yes. Well, that scene, I mean, the Birmingham bombing of the four little girls happened many, many months before. But it was the catalyst for Diane Nash and Jim Bevel to start to lay out a plan, a specific strategy for the pursuit of voting rights, and to start to target a community that might be able to amplify and where they might be able to illustrate the ills that had kept folks from voting and registering. And so when you talk with Diane Nash about it, it was the loss of those four little girls. It was their murder that activated her and thrust them into what would be known as the Selma campaigns. And so for me, you know, as a filmmaker, I was just very interested in tipping a hat to those two activists who had made that decision and why, but then also to just really place the audience right front and center emotionally to what it felt like to be Black in the Deep South in 1965.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ava DuVernay, and she directed the new film Selma. There were three marches that happened that your film depicts, three marches that attempted to get from Selma to Montgomery to demand the right to vote. Only the final march made it there. On the first time that peaceful demonstrators tried to march from Selma to Montgomery, they didn't get far at all. They were attacked in Selma on the Edmund Pettus Bridge across the Alabama River. They were attacked by police. That day became known as Bloody Sunday. And I want to pause here and play a brief first-person account of that march. This is from J.L. Chestnut, who was Selma's first and for a while Selma's only Black lawyer. He was a witness to this march. And in 1990, he told me he initially didn't agree with the idea of civil disobedience because as a lawyer, he believed you follow the law. And if you want to challenge an unjust law, you do it in the courts, not on the streets. But he eventually was swayed by Martin Luther King and came to believe in civil disobedience. And on the day of the march, he was working for the NAACP. He was still unsure that day whether the march would actually proceed, but he was prepared to do his part as a lawyer. So here's his description of that day.
I had gone across the river earlier, across the bridge, because they would not let lawyers march. You know, you had enough foot soldiers. What we didn't have was enough lawyers, and it didn't make sense to have lawyers in jail. So I had gone across the river earlier, not knowing whether there would be a march, and to get to a telephone, because once a march started, you would have the FBI, the press, and everybody fighting over the one telephone. So I went over there early to tie it up in case there would be a march. And I'd have to describe to the NAACP what was happening, because they were paying the bill. And I was over there tying up the telephone, and I looked up toward the bridge, and there was John Lewis, who's now Congressman John Lewis from Georgia, Atlanta. And this group of marchers coming toward this great line of state troopers and possemen. And I began to describe the scene over the telephone to New York. And then John and the group came face to face with the troopers. And I heard some voice, a state trooper, who said that, stop, this will be as far as you will be permitted to go. Turn around and go back to your churches. And then John and the others begin to kneel and pray. And then I heard something that sounded like a tear gas canister hit the pavement. And then there was smoke, bedlam, confusion, blood, tears, cries, and there were these big, hefty possumen swinging billy clubs the size of baseball bats and coming down across the heads of women and children. My eyes were hurting, my head was hurting, and New York was screaming over the telephone, what's going on, what's going on? And I tried to pull some women back out of the street, and it was just awful. It was one of the lowest days of my life. At that day, I lost all faith in America. I lost all faith in white people. I said, my God, Black people will never be citizens. We will never be what we ought to be in this land. And what is this? I have gone to Howard University. I'm a lawyer, an officer in the white man's court. And here these people are trampling on my folk in the streets, blood everywhere. And they're trampling on the Constitution, and nobody does anything about it because these people are black. And I was just almost in tears. And 2 days later, I had to revise and make a new assessment because white people and black people came from all over this nation that watched it on television, and they were thoroughly upset at what they saw. You know, it's easy to send a check down from New York and say, I'm with you. It's something altogether different to come down and lock hands with a black person and say, I'm ready to go to jail. I'm ready to die if necessary. And I saw hundreds and hundreds of people come from all over this land to join with us in this little town of my birth. And I had to look and reassess all over again. And my faith in this nation, my faith in the human race was restored.
And that was lawyer J.L. Chestnut on Fresh Air in 1990s describing the first voting rights march that tried to get from Selma to Montgomery. And those voting rights marchers are at the center of the new film Selma, directed by my guest Ava DuVernay. Ava, I'm sure you spoke to a lot of people who gave you first-person accounts of what happened on Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So describe to us what you wanted to show of the police attack on the demonstrators.
What an extraordinary account that was.
If you want to comment on it, go ahead.
That's just extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, just his voice, and he conjured it all for me as I was listening to him. And that's what I wanted to do with this, is to really breathe some life into the words Bloody Sunday. Most people don't even know the words anymore. They don't understand what it was and what happened there and what was at stake. That two by two, they walked over this bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge that's named after the Grand Dragon of the KKK at the time that it was built. These citizens, these black citizens, have to walk over that bridge every day, knowing who it's named after. And on this day, exactly as the elder says in the testimonial, Mr. Chestnut, that they were met by a militarized presence, police aggression, state troopers under the orders of George Wallace. And so my mission was just to put you in the middle of that action. And in reality, when we did the research, we found that the press was held back. You know, the press was not on the bridge. So all we have are those firsthand testimonials to tell us what it felt like. Even the very famous newsreel footage is from an angle that's a bit in the distance. And at one point, when the tear gas ballooned up, they lost sight of what was going on. I mean, literally, those marchers were lost in a smoke of tear gas, the horror of not knowing what was happening to them. And in fact, what was happening to them is they were having the life beat out of them. I mean, they were being pushed back on by horses, by batons. You know, I had someone tell me that someone had a bullwhip. They were being whipped back across the bridge, and they were literally run. I mean, we try to show this whole spirit of this time in 120 minutes, and what we don't show in the film is that they were actually run all the way back to their churches, back across the bridge, through the streets of Selma, back into their churches, and that there was a armed posse of just thugs under the orders of Sheriff Jim Clark at that time, who were just terrorizing black folk in the street if you were out in the street that day. So it was just an ugly, ugly business.
You weren't used to staging violent scenes. Your films have been small, independent character films. So how did you stage this demonstration in which a lot of people get hurt while at the same time protecting the actors from getting hurt?
Yes. Well, I am an independent filmmaker, and our forte is people in rooms. I had no experience with working on bridges with 500 extras and green screen and firearms and horses, and it was a massive production on that bridge and every time we were staging a march. But I just approached it in the same way that I approach any scene. What is the story here? And if you go into an action scene focused on the tear gas and the horses and all of the bells and whistles of the scene, and you miss the heart of the scene, because the horses aren't the story and the tear gas is not the story. It's the heart of the matter, the look on the marchers' faces as the horses race towards them, the horror, the terror, the thought on someone's face that this is it, this is how it will end for me. That feeling is what I went into these scenes with every day, a quest to capture the heart of the moment. And that put me at ease because I know how to do that.
Having never directed a scene like that before, a violent confrontation in which, you know, police are attacking peaceful demonstrators, what did you do to make sure no one was going to get hurt?
Well, we have our safety on set. I mean, you know, the stunt team, the medics, the standard things that should be done on any set. But there was also, you know, a question of emotional safety, because we were asking people, you know, all of our extras were from this place. I mean, we didn't bring in extras from Hollywood. We didn't bring in extras from Atlanta. We were in Selma, Alabama, staging these scenes. So extras were from the surrounding communities and Selma. I mean, this history is very much a part of the DNA of that place. And so so you're asking white citizens currently living there who may not feel and do not feel the way that we're asking them to feel on screen, to yell expletives, to hit their fellow community members, to yell and scream vile things. And you're asking, you know, the black citizens of that place to experience that and take it in. And that was really top of mind for me, to make sure that there was a meeting of the minds there, that there was a real understanding of what we were doing and why, because that emotional safety was also very important, that we were all clear.
What were you looking for in the faces of the black and white extras?
I mean, it's fantastic, to be honest with you, casting people outside of Los Angeles. You know, lines on the face, looking like real working people. You know, we had just a beautiful array of faces. We're really looking for faces that had life in them. You know, eyes, you know, we were really looking at eyes quite a bit when I would, you know, determine whether an extra was going to be, what scene they would be. You know, there's some eyes that you just look into them and you see that they're full of hope. And there are other eyes that you look into and you see they've seen some things and it might be harder. And just placing those within it. The tapestry of the extras, there's a woman named Cynthia Stillwell that we worked really closely with. It was important to find the right extras casting director. Usually extras casting director is probably someone I'd never talk about on other films, even though they all do great work. But in this, really the extras casting director, she cast Selma, those faces, those people.
By the way, you know, you mentioned that the Edmund Pettus Bridge was named after, was it the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan? Has the name of the bridge been changed?
No, nope. It's still the good old Edmund Pettus Bridge. He was a Confederate general and, yes, KKK Grand Dragon at the time, around when it's built. And so, regrettably, that is still the name of that bridge.
You know, your film really gets us to think about all that was on Martin Luther King's shoulders. I mean, not only like the whole movement, but the lives of the people in it. And, you know, when you're leading a march and deciding to move forward, it's kind of on you in some ways. And so, I mean, there was so much on his shoulders. And he was so young.
So young.
It's
so
like
young.
The older you get, the younger he gets.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You know,
he was 39 when
like
he died.
39. I mean, I feel like a young woman, and I'm older than Dr. King was when he died. I mean, he was 36 when he led these marches that we're talking about. I mean, John Lewis was 23 years old. It's incredible that, you know, how young they were. The oldest guy hanging around was like 40. But as you say, I mean, even with our poster for the film, it was important to me. And the reason why I love that image that we have on the poster is you stand behind King as you look at the poster. You know, it's a picture of the back of Dr. King. It's head and shoulders. And beyond him, you see a line of state troopers. And you are a marcher. You stand behind him. And, you know, just to think about the weight on his shoulders. I mean, not only was he leading a grassroots movement, you know, you had legislative proceedings that were happening that he was involved with. He was appealing and lobbying to
to the White House. He had personal concerns that were happening. Coretta was back home being threatened daily with the children. I mean, that weight and then the daily threats to his life. But, you know, the thing that really struck me about this time and the research and reading and talking to people was really that this was the first time that folks died directly on King's watch. You know, Jimmie Lee Jackson, James Reeb, Viola Luiso, these deaths happened in a 3-month period under his watch during, you know, the tactics that he was directing and approving and advocating for. And that was a real weight because for the first time, you know, of course, there had been many deaths throughout the movement, but this one was directly related to the very campaign that he was heading very specifically. And that, you know, is an unimaginable pressure and guilt. And we worked, David Oyelowo, I can't believe it's the first time we're saying his name, David Oyelowo, the actor, extraordinary actor who plays Dr. King so exquisitely, we worked a lot on that guilt, that weight, that fog of death, as we say in the film, and he captures it pretty beautifully.
He was actually attached to the film before you were signed to it. And I think he was instrumental in getting you on as the director. You had already worked with him in your previous film, Middle of Nowhere. He was really determined to play Martin Luther King. He'd wanted to play King for years. What's your understanding about why he was so committed to doing that? And I ask this especially because he's British. And he didn't grow up in America. He didn't grow up with the American Civil Rights Movement or with parents who were part of the American Civil Rights Movement.
No, I mean, he describes it as a calling that, you know, he says that God told him that he was going to play Dr. Martin Luther King before he died. This got locked in his spirit and he would never let it go through 5 directors who originally told him, no, you are not King. The first director told him, no, you are not King. The film changing hands year after year. Finally, he gets cast by the previous director who was attached, Lee Daniels. Lee Daniels decides to go and make The Butler instead. David found himself an actor who knew he was going to play King without a film. He brought on, lobbied for, cajoled, pushed, pulled, convinced, pitched the producers to the idea of hiring, you know, a woman who had made an independent for $200,000 that he had worked with previously, me. He called Oprah Winfrey and said, hey, got a project, and actually convinced her to come on board.
Let's hear a clip of David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King. And this is a scene where, you know, King has come to Selma to help organize voting rights protests. And in this scene, he's at a church addressing the black residents of Selma about the need to organize.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest, that means march, that means disturb the peace, that means jail, that means risk, and that is hard. We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking, we're demanding. Give us the vote.
Give us the vote.
That's David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King in a scene from Selma, which is directed by my guest, Ava DuVernay. Now, I have to say, that does not sound like an exact impersonation of Martin Luther King. Personally, I think that's a good thing. It's always difficult, I think, in historical movies or biopics, you know, when you're depicting real people that people know, especially somebody who has been as immortalized as Martin Luther King. We know how he sounds, you know, we know what he looks like. And sometimes the closer you get to an impersonation, the more it seems like an impersonation, the more imperfect it actually seems. Can you talk about trying to find the line between embodying, like doing his best to embody King while at the same time not looking like an impersonation?
I mean, it wasn't even a line to walk. We just walked away from anything that felt very, very close to King. You know, it was intentional. There was no mimicry that was ever going to happen. I mean, that was our first order of business, to stay as far away from the two or three things that, you know, really peg King in terms of voice and the vibrato and some of the quirks of his oratory. And we really focus on the spirit of him. You know, David doesn't look like King. David doesn't sound like King, but he kind of looks and sounds like King. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I do.
It's in there. You know what I mean? Like, it starts to be in there somewhere. This is a cinematic exploration of this time and this space and the spirit of this time. And so you just have to, you know, I won't even say get close, but not close enough. I mean, we were actually trying not to be close. We were trying to just be in a range that felt comfortable. Because the closer you get to what's real, exactly as you said, you know, the more you invite comparison and contrast and all kinds of, you know, very much like all of this that's happening around questions of accuracy. This is not meant to be fact, right? I think it's Faulkner that says something like, we don't want facts, we want truth. And so that's really what we were going for, the truth of the matter, the heart of the matter, the spirit of the matter, and not to be, you know, kind of dealing with approximations and mimics and impersonations.
But the thing is, when you're doing a historical film or a biographical film, you're dealing with facts. You're dealing with something that actually happened. And so there's always the question of, you know, what is your responsibility to the facts, to the truth as it happened? I know a film that's not a documentary isn't an act of journalism, but it's still, I always think that historical films still have a responsibility to history. And if you could just address a little bit the kind of landmines involved in doing, you know, any historical film.
With any historical film, everyone will not be pleased. And so for me, it was really about bringing in every character that you, every named character in Selma is a real person. So one of the first things I did when I came on board is get away and toss away all the composite characters or folks that this person represents these three real people, because it's easier to just have him named this and make him do this, because this is kind of what those three people did. You know, in trying to be truer to the facts, but really looking for the truth behind the facts, we really had to say, let's name these people. So we brought in, that was one of the early fears from some camps. There were going to be too many people in the film. But I think there's something beautiful about seeing King with his band of brothers and sisters. It's something important in illustrating that he did not do this alone. And so by bringing in all of the real people, you do open yourself up to the interpretations, the cinematic interpretations that we are creating of these people may not be the actual hard facts of every day of their life and every exact thing that they did. But for me as an artist, it was important for me. It was important to take the risk that they be named. Did John Doerr, the assistant attorney general, do a lot more, say a lot more? Is he so much more than the two scenes that he's given in the film? Of course. Diane Nash, just one of the architects of this whole movement. She was not in the film before. Was it important to name her and see her and let her live and breathe on screen? Even though we don't go into all of the full arc of her character, we made the choice that it was so. And so, no, I have 120 minutes to, you know, collapse many details, many people, many facts. And so the way that you do that, the way that I did it, is said, I'm not going to get bogged down in all of these facts that I will never be able to please everyone. I will try to get to the truth behind it. What were they trying to do? What were they trying to say? What did they stand for? Because that's the truth. And I'll try to get to that as best we can in the form of a film.
Ava DuVernay directed the new film Selma. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. In George Pelicanos' new novella, A writer and producer on a TV show finds out that a member of the production crew has been murdered, and the writer ends up tracking down the killers. It's a plot line that blends a few elements of Pelicano's writing and personal experience. He grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, had minor brushes with the law before eventually becoming a successful crime novelist, telling stories rooted in the district's neighborhoods. Pelicanos later became a writer and producer for two HBO series, The Wire and Tremé. Pelicanos' new book, The Martini Shot, collects several short stories along with the novella. When we spoke earlier this week, I asked Pelicanos to start with a reading from a story called String Music. The passage is written in the voice of an African-American teenager who's in a pickup basketball game and is being guarded by a young man named Wallace, who runs with neighborhood drug dealers. The narrator is describing how he's a better player than Wallace and could be making a mistake by embarrassing him on the court.
About the third time I drove the lane and kissed one in, Wallace bumped me while I was walking back up to the foul line to take the check. Then he said something about my sneaks, something that made his boys laugh. He was cracking on me, is all, trying to shake me up. I got a nice pair of Jordans, the penny style, and I keep them clean with Fantastic, but they're from, like, last year. And James Wallace is always wearing whatever is new, the 17s or whatever it is they got sitting up front at the Foot Locker, just came in. Plus, Wallace didn't like me all that much. He had money from his drugging. I mean to tell you that that boy had everything, but he had dropped out of school back in the 10th grade, and I had stayed put. My mom's always says that guys like Wallace resent guys like me who have hung in. Add that to the fact that he never did have my game. I think he was a little jealous of me. You want the truth. I do know he was frustrated that day. I knew it, and I guess I shouldn't have done what I did. I should have passed off to one of my boys, but you know how it is. When you're proud about something, you got to show it, especially down here. And I was on. I took the check from him and drove to the bucket. Just blew right past him as easy as I'd been doing all afternoon. That's when Wallace called me a bitch, right in front of everybody there. There's a way to deal with this kind of stuff. You learn it over time. I go 6'2", and I got some shoulders on me, so it wasn't like I feared Wallace physically or nothing like that. I can go with my hands, too. But in this world we got out here, you don't want to be getting in any kind of beefs, not if you can help it. At the same time, you can't show no fear. You get a rep for weakness like that. It's like being a bird with a busted wing, something like that. The other thing you can't do, though, you can't let that kind of comment pass. Someone tries to take you for bad like that, you got to respond. It's complicated, I know, but there it is.
And that's George Pelicanos reading from the story String Music. It's in his new collection called The Martini Shot. Well, George Pelicanos, welcome to Fresh Air. I loved that passage. I loved the language. Now, this kid in this confrontation has to figure this out. You want to kind of give us a sense of what he does to deal with the fact that this, you know, this bad guy, this Wallace, has picked on him in front of everybody else?
Well, it's like he said, he doesn't want to get in a fight with the guy because it's never going to end, or it's going to end really bad in a very violent way. And it might even come back on his family. But by the same token, you know, he can't be punked out completely because then you're going to be a target forever. So it's a choice how to walk that line and survive.
And he kind of diffuses it with a joke that makes all of Wallace's guys laugh, and then they move on. And then he stops humiliating him quite so directly on the court. But it doesn't work out so well as the stories proceed. You played a lot of basketball, street basketball coming up. You must have seen a lot of scenes like this.
Yeah, and experienced it too.
Yeah.
We used to go all over the city. I mean, it's a part of, you know, look, there were beefs. It's a part of growing up for a boy to get shook down. And you know, we used to play for push-ups, stuff like that. And you make the other guys do push-ups. And then sometimes you'd win and the other guys didn't want to do push-ups. And then what do? You know, does it elevate? And you just got to walk away knowing, well, we won. You know, that's the victories. We won. And they know it.
Do you still play basketball?
No.
It's a little tough on the knees at our age, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do. I'm physical. I ride my bike quite a bit. I kayak. I work out every day. And being physical is what kind of keeps me from thinking too much all the time, because this job is one where you are always working. No matter what you're doing, you're always working.
Taking notes? Do you keep a pad with you?
No, I have a good memory, and I carry my phone, which is now a writer's notebook.
Yeah.
And camera.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
It's everything.
You take pictures of scenes, people?
Absolutely. I ride around town on my bike. I take a lot of photographs with my phone. I will do something like there was a scene in my novel, The Cut, where Spiro Lucas breaks into this guy's house and to take something back. And I found the house that I wanted. And then so I went around to the alley, and I made sure that the sight lines were right. If you were breaking into this house, other people couldn't see you from the buildings beyond. And I found a perfect house to break into, and I took a bunch of pictures of it. And that's just one example. I do that all the time.
And got away before the suspicious activity was noticed and anybody called 911.
I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, people are always suspicious of me when I'm sort of lurking around taking photos, but nobody ever asked me anything.
Right. The other character in the story that we just read from is Sergeant Peters. He's a cop that drives, I guess, is it the midnight, the overnight shift. Mm-hmm. Is this based on somebody in particular?
I was riding with one guy for a while, and I would just listen to him and his sort of attitude about what he was doing. And he was a good guy, you know, but he was a little jaded too. And he had been doing it long enough so that, you know, he would see a kid and he would say to me, I knew his grandmother, you know. He knew the history of people. And, of course, a lot of the things in the story are taken from our rides together. And it's a very interesting time of night to be a police officer because, especially after 2 o'clock, let's say, the city kind of slows down and goes to sleep. But there's a lot of people out still. And the calls that you make, they're not homicides or manslaughters or anything like that. They are violent sometimes, but they're usually domestics. Or maybe some guy is drunk and he's gone to the wrong house and he's trying to put his key in the lock and he's wondering why the door isn't opening, because he's 2 doors down from where he lives, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a cool time of night to be out with the police.
Our guest is George Pelicanos. He has a new collection of short stories and a novella called The Martini Shot. The novella in this story, The Martini Shot, is told in the first person by a guy who's a writer and producer who's working on location, shooting a crime, a police series for television, which is a world you know well. And what's interesting about that, I guess a lot of people think of that, God, that must really be exciting and fun and glamorous. The picture you paint is pretty different. You want to kind of just describe what it's like a bit?
Well, it's a lot of hard work. I think people don't realize that the shows that I've worked on, we always worked, you know, an average of 12 to 14 hours a day, every single day, for 6 months straight, because it's a series. But I do find it very fun. There's a lot of writers that don't like being on set and they don't really like production, but I love it. And here's what I really like about it. First of all, when I'm wearing my novelist hat, I'm sitting in a room by myself for 5 or 6 months.
Right.
Because I front load all my research. Basically, I'm out there in the street for a couple months and then I come into the house and I really almost lock myself in for 5 months and I write 7 days a week. So then I get these jobs where I go into production on television, and I'm in a van in the morning, and I get step out of the van, and all of a sudden I'm working with 100 people every day. And these people are, I consider them to be artists, the DPs, the gaffers, the hair and makeup people, locations, costumes. We are all together as artists making something. I find that really interesting and fun. You know, I'd never read anything. I'd read a lot of Hollywood novels that really are about executives and actors and so on. But I'd never really read anything about a film crew before. So when I came back from, we wrapped in New Orleans. I was doing Tremé for HBO. As soon as I came back, I wrote this novella. And while it was still fresh in my head.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really close friendships and some intense sexual relationships because people – there's a sense of transience to it, but kind of you're spending so much time together and all this unity of purpose.
Well, I would see on these shows, I'd see people fall in love, and then at the end of the show, when it wrapped, they'd go their separate ways because they took jobs on opposite sides of the country, that kind of thing. And because it was sort of a doomed love affair in a way, they conducted it much more intensely, let's say. So this novella is pretty graphic sexually. And the reason it is because I just wanted to write about what it's like for people who are, they're not doing anything wrong. They're not cheating on anybody. You know, these are two single people, two consenting adults who are expressing their love in a physical way. And there's nothing dirty about that to me.
You know, you said that you grew up in, I guess, outside of Washington, D.C., and your dad had a coffee shop in town, and that you just observed and collected memories and voices. Were you thinking then that you were going to do anything with it?
I wanted to make movies. When I was a kid, that's what I wanted to do. And so these stories that I was making up in my head when I was delivering food for my dad on foot, I was 11 years old, were, in my mind, they were movies that I was writing. And I wasn't much of a book reader. So when I got to college, I took a class in crime fiction when I was a senior as an elective by a guy named Charles Misch, who's one of the people I dedicate this book to. He was the teacher. And although Mr. Misch and I didn't really talk much, if at all, he turned me on to reading books. And it was the first kind of book I had read that sort of spoke to my world, meaning it was about generally crime fiction deals with working class people who don't always win, but they have these little moments of, you know, inglorious redemption, but they don't win all the time, which is American literature is really about winners, if you think about it. And so the flame when it got turned on inside me, and I decided that's what I wanted to do. I want to write novels. So for the next 10 years, I just read a lot of books trying to teach myself how to become a writer while I was working a series of jobs like, you know, bartender, kitchen man, that sort of thing, lady shoe salesman, and getting a lot of material along the way. Not consciously, but sort of just living a full life, which I think is what any writer should do. You know, this job is not like being an athlete or a movie star where you have this very small window. So I didn't start writing until I was 31 years old.
You know, you also had an experience, which, you know, most crime writers haven't. When you were 17, you were playing with a friend and you accidentally shot him with your father's gun. The kid was shot in the face and he recovered and you became great friends. But I'm wondering...
He was my best friend from kindergarten.
I should say you remained good friends, yeah.
Yes.
But I wonder how that affected your perceptions of violence, having actually had that experience, and whether, I don't know, do you ever draw on that in your writing?
Well, I've seen what happens when somebody's shot. It's not the only time I've seen somebody shot. You know, in my dealings with homicide investigators, for example, one of the things they like to do is take me to the morgue. You know, they're trying to get me to throw up or something. And I've seen a lot of gunshot victims, and it's not a good thing. I don't own a gun. There's one thing. I'm not against responsible gun ownership, but it's not for me, to put it that way, because I know that teenage boys, if there's a gun in the house, they're going to find it, and they're going to mess around with it, because that's what happened to me.
So you do work in prisons and work with kids?
Yeah. For years, I've been doing reading programs, going to juvenile facilities here, and also into the adult population. The juveniles, particularly boys, go through a period where their minds are kind of messed up. They're scrambled. You know what I mean? It's like the tilt on a pinball machine. And when they're in their teens, the bulk of their brain is given over to impulse and adrenaline. But then when they get in their 20s, they've taken pictures of the brain, and it's dominated by conscience and reasoning. So there's a science to this. The people change. And, you know, I went through it too. So I know. I mean, I had my brushes with the law and so on, and actually it took me longer. You know, I was the last time I got arrested, I was 28 years old for a number of things in one night.
What were you arrested for when you were 28?
Oh, that was just a long night of I'd been to a wedding in the daytime, which is always a bad idea. And especially for, you know, my group of guys. And so I was ended up in the – I got in a little accident, fender bender in a parking lot, and it escalated into – it was more than one guy and me, and it was shoving and stuff like that. And then somebody called the police, and one of those guys blocked my car from behind, so I couldn't leave. And I saw the police pull into the parking lot, and I don't know, I was all jacked up on adrenaline and so on. I just got in my car and I took off, and I had to drive down the sidewalk to do it. So a high-speed chase ensued, let's put it that way. And I lost them because it was in my neighborhood where I grew up. I knew all the alleys and the side streets, but it was very dangerous what happened, because I was blowing red lights and, you know, cars were spinning, doing 360s. I'm not, you know, it was exactly what you think it is. Anyway, the next day they called me at my apartment and said, would you like to come in, or would you like us to come arrest you? Because they had my license plate numbers.
Right.
So I went by my parents' house. I was getting married in 4 months.
Oh,
like I
goodness.
Said, 20, I was 28 years old. I mean, I wasn't a kid. Went by my parents' house. I told them, Mom and Dad, I'm about to go turn myself in, this and that. Anyway, I got charged with a bunch of stuff, including driving on the sidewalk, which was my favorite charge of that checkered night. So I ended up having to go to this class at night for 6 weeks, and I was looking around at the people in the classroom, and I saw a bunch of guys who, to me, they were losers, you know what I mean? And then I came to the realization that I was one of them.
Uh-huh.
And so I sort of grew up. I got married shortly thereafter. 2 or 3 years later, I wrote my first novel, started a family. People do change. I believe in that.
George Pelicanos has a new book called The Martini Shot. It collects several short stories along with a novella. You can read an excerpt of The Martini Shot and hear a longer version of our conversation on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.